Brian Taylor joins us now, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Most recent book is Russian Politics, A Very Short Introduction. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm good, Tommy. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for taking the time. Tell me what's going on with Russia and Ukraine, and maybe some context for how long this has been going on, because for a lot of us, you know, we accept these things as, yeah, it is like the Middle East. It's Russia and Ukraine. It's been going on forever and will go on forever. But give me some thoughts on that.
Sure. So I guess I would say it started in 2014 when Russia illegally annexed the Russian region of Crimea and then sponsored a war against the central government in the southeast part of Ukraine. But then it really completely kicked off February 2022 when Russia launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, tried to seize the capital of Kyiv and overthrow the government. They obviously failed to do that. So since those early weeks of the war in 2022, there's been a war raging all along the eastern and southern part of Ukraine and along the border and into, the area around Russia. And, you know, the story is Russia's taking massive losses, probably over 200,000 dead in the last 3.5 years, but still keeps pushing on. And the question is, you know, can Ukraine stay in the fight, and who's going to back their effort to protect themselves?
That's a lot of people dead. To put that in context, compare it maybe to different wars, and also I think in terms of area and damage, if you could make it the equivalent of maybe the United States and Canada, I don't know if that's accurate or not, but how much damage has been done to either country, just so we understand, because it's on the other side of the world to us, right? And we can't pronounce half of the countries, and we have to look it up on Google Maps. You understand what I'm saying, huh, Professor?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of the scale, Ukraine is the second largest country in Europe after Russia itself. Mm-hmm. If you laid Ukraine on top of the United States, the eastern part would be in New York and the western part would be in Chicago, right? So it's, you know, it's a fairly large territory. And in terms of the damage, pretty much all of it is taking place on the territory of Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine has launched some attacks against Russia, but most of the damage is taking place in Ukraine. Russia currently occupies an area that's the equivalent of the size of Switzerland and Austria. So it's, you know, quite a big amount of territory, about 20% of Ukrainian territory. And if people just go online and look at the images of some of these towns and cities in eastern Ukraine, many of them have been leveled to the ground in Russia's effort to, seize them. They're destroying the territories that they're setting out to seize, and they're leveled with artillery and missile fire and that sort of thing. So it's a very brutal war, high numbers of casualties. You know, Russia has taken more casualties in the last 3.5 years than it has in all of the wars the Soviet Union fought between World War II and 2022, or the Soviet Union and then Russia. Mm-hmm. So very deadly war on the Ukrainian side as well. But the Middle East analogy, I guess, holds to a certain extent in that there's no sign of a peace deal anytime soon. Vladimir Putin continues to pursue this war.
So who can outlast whom when it comes to this? And what about casualties on the Ukraine side or deaths?
Yeah, we have less good information on the number of deaths on the Ukrainian side, but it's probably around half of the Russian numbers, I would guess. Yeah, around 100,000. That's just a ballpark number.
But Professor, let me just stop you for 1 second, because I think, you know, that human part of it gets lost in all that. That's 300,000 people dead to accomplish what?
Right.
Not much, right?
Putin has not accomplished his goals, but his ultimate goal is to put Ukraine under Russian control.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has stated multiple times that he believes Ukrainians and Russians are one people, that Ukraine is not a real country. He stated that just again a few weeks ago. And he also stated anywhere that a Russian soldier puts his boots, that's now Russian territory. So he has a very expansive view of what Russia is entitled to, which is inconsistent with international law, and he's committing war crimes to try and accomplish these goals.
So who can outlast whom when it comes to this thing?
Well, obviously, Russia's the bigger country. Its population is more than three times bigger than Ukraine's. Obviously, its economy is bigger, its territory is bigger, and it's getting help in various ways from China and Iran and North Korea. But Ukraine has fought very bravely. Russia has not seized a single regional capital in Ukraine that it didn't control prior to the war in 2022, seized and held, I should say. And Ukraine has had the backing of, you know, much of the rest of the world, certainly Europe, North America, parts of Asia. And that has provided Ukraine with the weapons and funding to keep it going, even though no other countries are committing troops to support Ukraine. This financial and military support has basically led the war to be fought to a standstill. And I think Ukraine could still, you know, defeat Russia's attempt to impose its will on Ukraine if the West, including the United States, are willing to continue to support Ukraine's effort to remain free. And I think that's the big question we're facing right now under the Trump administration, who hasn't pursued a single coherent policy over the last, you know, 7 months, but seems to be stepping away from what the U.S. has provided Ukraine in the past.
So the president said he was going to end the war in Russia and Ukraine in the first 24 hours. Then he said he was joking. Now, I don't know what's going on with him and Putin and Zelensky, whose friend is who's what. We'll talk about what serves the United States' best interest, because it seems as though 300,000 people are dead because China and North Korea and Russia are fighting a proxy, well, not Russia, a proxy war, but against the United States and Europe. And meanwhile, it's not the United States people that are dying or the North Korean people that are dying. It's the Russians and the Ukrainians. 620 traffic now, WWL. 624, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Brian Taylor, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Most recent book is Russian Politics. Very short introduction. Professor, I don't mean to harbor on or dwell on a 300,000 people, but we just kind of toss that off. Not you, but I'm saying, and that's like three Tiger stadiums here, three Ann Arbor stadiums in Michigan, full of people just dead because of this thing, right?
Yes, that's correct.
It's
crazy. It's two Syracuse cities, right?
Yeah,
the
exactly.
Population of Syracuse is about 150,000. So, yeah, it's double that.
So let's talk about President Trump, Zelensky, Putin, his role in this, what the United States can do, should do, what serves our best interest. That's a lot, but jump in where you feel comfortable, because you are the director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs.
I guess the first thing I would address is President Trump's position, which has, you know, been back and forth over the last few months. And many people thought there had maybe been an important change earlier this week when he announced in the Oval Office that he was going to sell a lot of U.S. weapons to Europe that would then pass them on to Ukraine and would keep Ukraine in the fight. It was indicated in some interviews that he had asked President Zelensky about whether Ukraine could actually hit Moscow and St. Petersburg, Russia's two biggest cities. And Zelensky said, if you give us the weapons, we can. But then, you know, since that initial statement, it seems that things are a bit unclear. The Europeans were a bit blindsided by this. I guess no real specific plans were in place. And yesterday, President Trump said, well, actually, they shouldn't, you know, try and attack Moscow. And so I think the question is, you know, which weapons, how many, when will they get there? That's all the details that need to be ironed out. So if we compare where we are now to where we were, you know, it was 5-6 months ago when President Trump and Vice President Vance were, you know, attacking President Zelensky in the Oval Office. We're certainly in a better place now than then. But I'm not convinced yet we've seen an important change in U.S. policy to, you know, back to what it had been the previous 3 years, which was one of, you know, strong support for Ukraine. So I think we still have to wait and see. You know, President Trump talks about getting it done in 2 weeks. This week he said, well, if there isn't a deal in 50 days, we're going to put heavy sanctions on trade with Russia. But I think most people have noticed that when he threatens sanctions, that it doesn't always happen. So we're going to have to wait and see what, you know, which way this goes. And if I can just address the last part of your sure. question, you know, what's in the U.S. interest? My view, you know, since the beginning of the war has been that the U.S. is best served by an international system in which great powers can't, invade and take over the territory of their neighbors, and that there are some rules that states have to live by and they have to live in their own borders, and that the U.S. is actually getting a pretty good deal, if I can be cynical about it, in terms of a major adversary. Russia has been an adversary for, you know, quite a long time, is seeing its military power degraded and destroyed at the cost of zero American lives. It means defense orders and jobs for Americans. And, you know, I think it's important for European security, which is our biggest trading partner, that Russia be stopped here. So I would like to see a U.S. policy of continuing economic and military support for Ukraine, which is really a very small part of the overall budget. Like, I think it's less than 1% that we've provided every year over the last few years. So it's not like it's a huge dent in our coffers, but it keeps the possibility of a Europe that's secure and peaceful and an economically thriving area, you know, alive.
Yeah, somebody texted in and said, no more money to the black hole in Ukraine. But it would seem to me, first of all, a weaker Russia is better for the United States. And secondly, you know, a long time ago, I was kidding around about the Hubble telescope when they had trouble with the professor. And I said, well, that's money down the drain. Somebody texted in and said, well, no, that's not true at all. That money was spent in the economy and educated people's children and bought this and bought that and bought the other thing. And the same can be said of the weapons that are being sent to Ukraine. Those are manufactured in the United States?
Yes. And in a lot of cases, we have been sending Ukraine older stocks of weapons and buying new stocks of weapons that create jobs, you know, in business for American defense companies. So, yes, there is money going to this. I mean, the person who texted in is correct that the U.S. has spent over $100 billion supporting Ukraine, but Europe has spent more than that. And I guess the question is, do we think there's some value in helping the second largest country in Europe remain free and not under Russian control? Because I'm pretty convinced that if Russia got its way with Ukraine, that everyone in Europe would be asking for even more American commitments to help defend Europe. And people could say, oh, we can walk away from Europe. They can take care of themselves. And certainly, I think most people believe they could do more. But it also has been an American security interest for the last century that Europe not be dominated by an aggressive authoritarian country. And we fought in two world wars for that principle. We created NATO for that principle. So it's been a longstanding U.S. security interest. And I think, you know, respecting that and continuing that involves spending a little bit of money, you know, a cup of coffee per week per person, something like that, you know, $3-4 to keep Ukraine free and independent. And I would also say that the area that Russia occupies and controls, it's not like the war ends for the people who live there. They're subject to, you know, torture and repression and killings and things like that. So from the Ukrainian point of view, they have no choice but to fight back because, you know, giving into Russia just means more death and destruction for the people who live there.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time. We'll talk to Mike Strain. We come back right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Thursday morning, July 17th. Around these parts on Thursday morning, we connect with Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, and today is no different. How you doing, Dr. Mike Strain?
Man, I am ready. We are going to have a what's called a UCG, Unified Command Group meeting, the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness in Baton Rouge at 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. We're going to be focusing on today on the weather. As you know, that there's some severe weather coming through, and we could see 4 to 6 inches of rain across the metro area between now and Saturday. Some areas around the Atchafalaya Basin could see up to 10 inches. And so, you know, it's not a hurricane. It's not just a massive storm. But we are using this. Everyone's getting together for the first in-face tabletop-type exercise because we have a lot of new people there in GOSEP, which is good. I've been a member of GOSEP and sat at that table now 18 years. There are a lot of people who will be there for the first time. And this is the heartbeat center whenever we have disasters. And the governor runs it. And, of course, there and the National Guard and everything. And that's where, you know, all the logistics, and that's the central point from there. You know, everything, you know, spans out into the parishes. So that'll be at 10 o'clock today, and we're gearing up for that.
Mike, you know, while this will turn out to be maybe, hopefully, a non-event, you don't know, there is something to be said. First of all, we should be thankful that it is a non-event. And secondly, there's something to be said for y'all all getting together and having not a dry run because there might be some rain, but having a rehearsal, right?
That's correct. And if you look at emergency preparedness across the United States and much of the world, Louisiana is the model that other states and countries follow because, one, you know, we have a lot of real live exercises. We've dealt with lots of disasters. It's a very good model. It is, you know, well put together, and the whole, and it works very, very well, like a finely tuned Swiss watch. And it is important that we get together, continue to train, and also that we're prepared for this in case, heaven forbid, you know, there's some severe flooding or there's some issues, or there's a 30% chance there could be some tornadoes in different areas, so that we can respond appropriately and rapidly, you know, during the immediate phase, and then also work on recovery. And it's important that we all know what each other's roles are, and you have that face-to-face continuous contact so that, you know, in a moment's notice, I can pick up the cell phone and talk to the, you know, the adjutant general, the National Guard, or the head of state police, or fire marshal, or whoever that might be, to deal with whatever issue or logistics that we have. So it works very, very well, and it works almost seamlessly in the way, you know, at 10 a.m., normally we meet during the disaster twice a day, at 10 a.m. and then again at about 4 p.m. So any issue that comes up at 10 a.m. has to be resolved. And basically the effects, everything we're doing in place by 10 a.m. the next morning. And so and it all works. Everyone in that room, if something has to be dealt with, someone in that room is responsible for it. And then we work together through our secondary emergency command centers, which I have one at the Department of Ag and Forestry, because I'm responsible for emergency fuel for the government. Any emergency fuel need, I'm responsible to make sure that they get that fuel. We deliver that fuel. Also, responsible for pets and livestock. So when pets are evacuated, we're responsible to assist in that evacuation and then be there to assist in housing those animals. We also work in the areas of logistics and fire control. Wildland fires is under us, and, of course, State Fire Marshal, we coordinate with them. Structural fires under them, and then we work together on everything else. And then overall looking at environmental disease control, any diseases that might pop up in the environment, we work together on that, whether it's plant-based, animal-based, mosquito-based, or whatever. So we have a lot of responsibilities during disasters. And, you know, our goal is so that it never becomes a secondary disaster due to the primary weather event or other event.
Mike, let me talk to you about tell you what, I just noticed the clock. Let me take a break for traffic here. And when we come back, we'll talk about this whole Coca-Cola corn fructose thing, corn fructose syrup, whatever they call it. Would that be good for Louisiana or not as it relates to sugar cane? I'm getting text about this. Coca-Cola saying they didn't really confirm or deny what President Trump said, but they're talking about making America healthy again. I don't know that cane sugar is any better for you than corn fructose. I don't think a lot of sugar is good for you either way, but we'll see what it means, the business part of it, when we return. We're talking to Agricultural Commissioner Mike Strain. In case you don't know, President Trump says that Coca-Cola will switch from artificial flavoring, which is corn, I guess he means corn fructose, to real cane sugar. Coke said they've not confirmed it. All Coca-Cola brands are wholesome beverages manufactured in compliance with federal law. and the president saying that Coke had agreed to use real cane sugar and not, I guess it's corn fructose. Mike will explain what all that is when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:56, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Both of your briefs have been filed and have been submitted to Judge Mike Strain. This is the case of high fructose corn syrup v. cane sugar. Judge Strain, tell me what's going on here. I don't understand. What is high fructose corn syrup? What does it mean for Louisiana agribusiness and cane sugar? And is one better than the other? Tell me.
Well, high fructose corn syrup is a sweetener made from corn starch. So it's processed. The starch is broken down into glucose using enzymes, and then they convert some of the glucose to fructose. So first of all, it's highly processed.
Okay.
And secondly, you know, there's a lot of discussion, a lot of research going on, you know, trying to, you know, really link high fructose corn syrup to fatty liver and fat in the liver, fat in the body, and overall saying that, you know, granulated sugar made from sugarcane and or beets is healthier. Overall, you know, the recommendation is no more than 36 grams of sugar per day. So there will be more research on that. But the bottom line is high fructose corn syrup is a processed sugar made from corn starch by an acid enzyme process. And so that's one thing, it's highly processed.
This started,
so, you know, we've always been.
This all started, Mike, for corn farmers who were trying to find a way to improve, increase the use of that product, correct?
Increase the use of that product in many different ways. And I can tell you the high fructose corn syrup part of the corn is a critical thing for corn farmers. Now, we are very prejudicial because we believe our cane sugar and our cane sugar is the most delicious in the world. Mm-hmm. And we are the largest producer of cane sugar in the United States. We produce more cane sugar than Florida. And so for us, this is a big step forward. Cane sugar is a very natural sugar, and we think it tastes better. Now, if you look at some cultures such as in Mexico and others, they really prefer, you know, cane sugar, you know, in their Coca-Cola and in their other products. So it's natural. It's very sweet. We have a lot of it. You know, in addition to that, so this is very good news for our sugarcane farmers here in Louisiana. Also, the fact that we are now going to be shipping sugar to Cuba. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, the mm-hmm. country that was the world's largest exporter of sugar mm-hmm. 20 years ago now is going to be importing sugar from Louisiana. So we have that underway as well.
Why is that?
Sugar is doing pretty well. Why? Because they've lost over 60% of their production of all their agricultural products in the last 5 years. Simply, you know, they're on their knees. They have no fertilizer. They don't have modern varieties. They have no equipment. And so, you know, they just can't, you know, they just can't feed themselves. And now, in order to make rum, which is a big deal there in Cuba, they're going to have to be importing sugar because they don't produce enough sugar on the island to make their own rum, and which is one of the things they do export to other parts of the world.
I'll say it. No, thank you, communism. Real quick, corn farmers in Louisiana is secondary to sugarcane farmers, and would this, and we only have 20 seconds, Mike, would that hurt the corn farmers in Louisiana?
No, it wouldn't. Most of our corn here in Louisiana is used to go into actually to chicken feed, and then we export the rest. So it's not, we don't really process our corn here hardly at all.
So it could be about win-win. You know, thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. We'll be back.